our guest, Mr. Alan Buttle. He is a researcher, and he has started up a new show called The Alan Buttle Show. You can actually catch it, for the most part, on grism.blogspot.com to get more information. He came recommended to us, so we're going to put him on the air here. And again, he's being featured over at Grism equally at the moment. And so we wanted to hear more about what Alan is all about. And I did meet Alan just a little bit on the Christmas Eve special show with Graham Hart and Breiser. And so, Alan, without further ado, welcome to Inside the Eye Live, live from Riyadh in Saudi Arabia now.
Well, thank you very much, Dennis. It's a real pleasure to be on your show. And yeah, I'm just a normal guy who's dedicated my life to research, really. And I've been lucky enough to be able to dedicate a lot of time to that, and I'm just simply trying to broaden the broaden the discussion and touch sort of obviously introduce elements that most people don't ever hear about through the Jewish mainstream media, as you mentioned, like, for example, the Jewish domination over pretty much every aspect of our society. And seeing how that fits in with,
you know, sort of, you know, it's funny, Alan, they'll call you and I an anti-Semite for even daring to say that. But there was just recently some type article posting came out of the Jerusalem Post that says, hey, we built America. We control its institutions. We control the financial system of America. And the fact that they only give us $3.8 billion isn't nearly enough. The Americans owe us more. And yet if we were to.
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, can you imagine the chutzpah of these people?
Chutzpah is exactly the word, isn't it? They've got no shortage of this sort of arrogance, and actually they make life very easy for us, because in fact they declare everything openly and publicly. You know, all the agendas they're getting up to, including of course mass immigration into the Western world and the white genocide, which is actually, explicitly stated by numerous Jewish, academics and, these people.
Abe Foxman himself even opened a call for the elimination of white people in general and in total. I mean, Abe Foxman, the head of the ADL, actually called for that. Now, why he was not arrested, tried and executed as an enemy of the American people, I don't know, quite frankly. Because to me, these types of statements are treasonous and should have been dealt with. Okay,
and first I think of all,
who is Alan Buttle?
Oh, sorry.
Real quick, because we don't know you, quite frankly. You seem like you're new on the scene. I don't know.
That's
why I'm here. You came to me highly recommended by a few people. We've noticed that you showed up over on, again, grism.blogspot.com, which is one of the major distribution networks now for this type of content. And how did you get into this type of research? How did you get into researching Western systems and the Jewish question?
Yeah, well, it's come about after a long, as I say, many, many years of research. And it's only relatively recently that I've really got my head around the Jewish sort of key to understanding what's going on in our society. And and actually the reason that I've been featured on the Grism page primarily is because I actually met Breiser at Alison Chablos' court trial, where I was there to support Alison, and as of course she ended up getting prosecuted for a breach of the Communications Act in the UK for writing songs that mocked the official story of the Holocaust. So I went there to support her, and we spent some time in the pub afterwards, and I met Brian, and he sort of we became in contact, sort of thing. And
okay,
and I was actually going
to. How did you hear about the Alison Chablos issue?
Cause I was a keen follower of the Andrew Carrington Hitchcock show for quite a long time, and I had been following sort of Alison's trial sort of thing, so decided to go along and support her, and obviously by this point I was very aware of the Jewish issues, but that was my real introduction to Grism and these kind of things. But before that, I've been doing a lot of research myself, and I'd already made quite a few documentaries on various charities, so-called charities, and I made a documentary on J. Jeremy Corbyn as well, which showed him in a different light to how a lot of
people
would like British, to see him as a sort British, of man of the people.
Yeah, you're a British citizen.
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay, and then when you talk about the charities, I know oftentimes charities is used kind of like a misnomer in British politics, British political organization. They're not charities at all. They are basically NGOs being funded by Israel or some type of Jewish special interest group. This would be like the campaign against anti-Semitism, for instance. It's not a charity. There's nothing charitable about it. It's a political advocacy group that puts forward and advances a Jewish-only policy inside of the UK. So which charities were you doing research on and then releasing information about?
Yeah, charities like, for example, Amnesty International, which was started by actually a relative of the Rothschild family, who obviously from there on it became one of the world's leading sort of so-called human rights charities. This was started up by a Jewish solicitor, very closely connected by blood to the Rothschild family. So I did some research on Amnesty and showed how their campaigns supported very well the war effort or the propaganda war effort with the American people, sort of to get into Iraq and other sort of war agendas that they had.
International has often been used as a fifth column element to push this idea of responsibility to protect. Oh, there's a genocide happening. You need to go to war now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, they use all these fear and dramatic ways of presenting whatever information they have, but more often than not, it's found to be complete lies, and actually there's just a very clear, obvious agenda behind it all. And obviously, Amnesty International in recent years have got involved in the gay rights and feminism angles as well. So they've really branched out. But these are the kind of so-called charities that exist in the that are very prevalent in our mainstream media and our social media, and it'll often be the mainstream media that refers to other corrupt organizations like Amnesty International to justify their position on things like things like war and it's sort of you have Amnesty International pushing the sort of Western side, and then you have other kind of so-called charities and groups pushing the anti-imperialist and anti-Western agenda at the same time. So they sort of work in collaboration with each other, I find.
Yes, I agree with you on that. What other charities did you look at?
Is Amnesty
International really a charity?
I mean, they're technically a charity because they're registered as a charity, but they're not a charity at all.
Aren't they like a non-profit political organization advancing a political agenda?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And everything that they do can be understood very clearly if you understand the objectives of the global Jewish establishment, because everything fits in perfectly with what these goals are.
How much money does Amnesty International make? How much is their fund?
I can't remember exactly offhand, but we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars per year, sort of thing. They're not a small operation. No. And they've also had a lot of very important people working for them, including Zbigniew Brzezinski, who is one of the leading advisors to various US presidents, and is very well connected to obviously the Rothschild family and Henry Kissinger, and he helped found the Trilateral Commission, I believe. So they've got very, very big names involved in Amnesty International. Most of these documentaries that I was making were before I became aware of the Jewish issue, so they sort of omit that element of it.
Which is still good to know how you developed anyways over time. Certainly I've given my development. So after this, like say Amnesty, just give us one other example of a documentary about some charity that you've done.
Yeah, I did a documentary on the WWF, for example, which was an interesting charity that had, the World Wildlife Fund.
I was thinking of World Wrestling Federation.
Oh, no, yeah, same initials. But they're probably not so apart from each other as you'd immediately think. But it's got very, very elite people involved at every stage of the World Wildlife Fund, and in fact I find that this is another globalist organization to progress the global Jewish agenda. For example, Julian Huxley was one of the founder members of the World Wildlife Fund, and he is of course highly implicated in all the sort of MK Ultra and secret society stuff, and his brother of course wrote Brave New World, and obviously very, very well connected to the royal family as well, because Prince Philip, the Queen's husband, was involved from the very start of the World Wildlife Fund. And ironically, when he was the president of the World Wildlife Fund, he was out in India shooting tigers, because that's, of course, what you do if you're interested in looking after wildlife, isn't it? But it's a way they've used the charity to capture huge swathes of land and actually sort of sequester the land for, so-called conservation, which actually just more or less means that you take control of the land for your own purposes and refuse sort of local people the access to it. So it's been used for numerous different sort of political agendas, this organization, over the years. But to be honest, we can from the outside, we can see some of the things that they're doing, but we don't really know to what extent they're really operating and what their real what they're really getting up to behind the scenes. Because I think, for example, a lot of these so-called child protection charities are actually fronts for organized child trafficking and these kind of things, because obviously these kind of organizations have the greatest access to children. And we know that the elite are very into sort of the sort of child sex trade industry and these kind of things. So from analyzing, for example, the people involved in Save the Children International, it really seems to me that it's far more likely to be a front for a massive child trade, to be honest. And so I think a lot of these charities do the exact opposite of what they tell us they're actually doing.
And of course, as you've developed and you being a British citizen, are not so keen, theoretically anyways, would not have been so keen to the 9/11 fraud as we were in America. But the 9/11 fraud really turned your vision onto a specter of society that you never looked at before. And that would be then what we call the Jewish problem today. Would that be correct?
Yeah, eventually, yeah. Well, I think with 9/11, I suppose a lot of people who have, who just saw the pictures and couldn't believe that, you're not honestly expecting me to believe that these towers just collapsed like that, are you? From these two planes making those three buildings collapse. So obviously, having come to that realization, for me, it was just a case of researching until some sort of logical explanation can be made, because it raises so many questions. How on earth? Because we know that it didn't happen like they're telling us. So how did they manage to do it? Which groups were involved? Sort of why is it that how is it even possible? How is it possible for all the media to lie in sync? How is it possible for the BBC to report the collapse of Building 7 before it even happened, and these kind of questions, and obviously that just I wasn't satisfied until I discovered sort of there is a clear Jewish motive behind it, and we have all the people's names like Dov Zakheim Wolfowitz and lots of Jewish involvement within, because it's a mixture between Jews and Freemasons, isn't it, really, who control things. And I think through those organizations and sort of we can get to the bottom of most of the things that are going on, I believe.
From the 719 area code, hi, welcome to Inside the Eye Life.
Hi, Fetch. I can't listen live, so I'm not sure what you're talking about now, and I hope I don't interrupt. I just wanted to make a brief comment about why I got into white nationalism, and okay. I think I can offer some insight to that I think can really help our movement. And it comes down to the question of what was World War II about? They were teaching me as a young man that they're implying that they went to war so white people couldn't have their own nation. And I knew that was wrong. And so I got in, you know, with David Duke and David Irving and reading all the revisionist books. And all of this revisionist history that your guest last week, that's what I'm listening to now, Fetch, is your last week's show. Goodrich, all that stuff is very important. To me, that is the goal, because it's with these lies they got us shackled, but it's just too big of a step for an activist. We cannot allow them to call us racists or Nazis. And the question comes down to what was World War II about? And Fetch, after college, I probably talked to 100 World War II vets, and none of them went to war anything about Jews. Not the fascists, not that whatever that means, the brown shirts, nothing. We got attacked by Buddhists, for Christ's sake. World War II, from that generation's perspective, was to preserve nationalism from the multicultural Axis power, this global diverse alliance. And when they weaponized World War II history to only be about Jews and Nazis, that's how they weaponized it. And my point is, Fetch, I've always been wondered, why haven't we, I call them, they don't out me, I out them. You're a goddamn racist, rot Nazi. It's just like the Mexicans right now. The Mexi-Nazis are invading us for Liebestraum. We've got the same situation, a multicultural coalition invading Europe and invading the United States, and our movement is not calling them Nazis and racist. I'm just flabbergasted. And by letting this big cinch in our armor open, Fetch, they have labeled us un-American. And then we walk around talking revisionist history so many people can't handle that big bite. I know it's the goal, but we need steps in between, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And when we allow them to rewrite regular history and we get hung up on revisionist history, in many people's minds, we're not even on the playing field. We're un-American Nazis who deserve a bullet in our head. And I out them. I chase Democrats down the street calling them racist Nazi scum. They fold like a lawn chair. And I don't know, we can definitely call them racist and Nazis, because from a World War II perspective, if you want to take away somebody else's nation, you're a Nazi. It's just that simple. I don't know. You got any comments?
I'll leave that. Alan, how about you? You've been dealing with this issue a little bit. So what do you say to the caller? Your name, by the way, first name, please.
Dan.
Dan, what do you have to say to Dan about World War II was this? I believe he's probably right. It was sold as a nationalist idea to the American soldier. But I don't believe the American soldier was playing it on a nationalist field. He was working with really Jewish internationalism. I think he was just fighting what he believed. But that's not what he was being put to use for.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the way, most soldiers are, you know, brought into wars, obviously, through their trust in their higher order, you know, and as far as the West has been concerned, I think we've been controlled for a very, very long time. I mean, I've recently made a podcast about Hitler's connection to the international bankers, and I look at it in a more sort of, you know, scientific way to try and figure out a most likely explanation for what was going on, and sort of showing how Hitler had employed an economics minister and a president of his Reichsbank to be one of the great friends of Montague Norman, the governor of the Bank of England, and a great friend of Benjamin Strong, who was the president of the Federal Reserve Bank in the 20s, and this Schacht guy was setting up political parties with Jews in the in Germany before he actually decided to switch to supporting Adolf Hitler. And so actually I think this whole, I mean, personally, and obviously a lot of people within the movement that I associate with, which is obviously like white nationalist, white survivalist movement, I like to call it, because we are under threat of our survival. I actually think that being associated with Nazism actually weakens us a lot, because people immediately have that instinctive reaction about it because of all the lies they've been told about Nazis and the Holocaust and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, Dan, you can stay through the... We're going into break. Dan, if you want to stay through the break, welcome. Sure. It's The Fetch with Alan Buttle. Again, it's Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. Back right now. All right, everybody, welcome back. It's The Fetch, Inside the Eye Live, intelligent media for the politically aware. Today's date, January the 5th, 2019. Happy New Year, everybody. First show for yours truly, not the first show for the show. Of course, we had Paul English with Michael Tom Goodrich on for this past Thursday, the primetime show. Great show, by the way, everybody. I can't say everybody, but there was certainly a lot of good positive feedback on that. So thanks a lot for Paul English for filling in. Always welcome. Class guy, quite frankly. Of course, with Michael Tom Goodrich equally. Our guest right now, first, we want to put something out there to Dan, who is still standing on the line, I believe, from, I think, the 719 area code. If you cannot get to Inside the Eye Live on the internet, we do have a Listen Live number. It's part of the services we offer here. You want to call 1-America, of course, plus 1, then 605-468-4702. That's 1-605-468-4702. You know what's funny about those lines, guys, is you know who uses those lines a lot? Truckers. They'll be driving across the nation, and they will actually call in while they're driving and listen on their phones while they're going. So, again, you can hear the show at 1-605-468-4702. That's 1-605-468-4702. That is the listen-in line. And, of course, the listener call-in line is 1-323-275-1314. That's 1-323-275-1314. Now, Dan, you were talking about something real quick, and we're going to get back down on, of course, our guest. But you were talking about a great phrase you came up with, and that is a survivalist movement, a white survivalist movement. That's a great term. I think you should be commended on that.
I think it was your guest that came up with that.
It's Dan. Or Alan. Okay, Alan, I thought you'd... Sorry about that. Alan, that was a great comment then. Sorry about that, Alan. See?
Well, thanks.
I'm going to let you do the show. First, but... Dan, I'm going to just turn the show over to you now since you seem to have a better handle on this than I do today. And Alan, enjoy. No, just kidding.
I'll just sum up Alan, and hang up phrase. So you can go on. I don't even know the topic because I was listening to last week's show. But anyways... By allowing them, we're in a revisionist history, and as an activist, it didn't help me much at all. In fact, it dug me in a hole, and it actually allowed them to paint me as un-American Nazi. And I've always been they had a question, what was World War II about? And if we defend normie history instead of revisionist history, we have only got 15 more yards to go, guys. That's it. But as soon as we abandon and allow them to rewrite normie history, and they did, and they made it only about Nazis and Jews when it was about the Axis powers, the most multicultural global alliance ever. We were attacked by Buddhists and the Muslims were helping the Germans on and on. And it had nothing to do with Jews. And we need to defend first and foremost. And I, without any dishonesty, I have been doxing them as Nazis and racist, and they fold like a lawn chair. And I put on the mantle of the mindset, of World War II vets before television came along and rewrote it and weaponized it. We should all be calling them. What would happen, Fetch, if David Duke and Don Black would have started out their career, and they're the big dogs, and I proudly donate $10 a month to both of them, right? But if they would have been come out calling them our opponents Nazis and racists, my God, think where we would be. Think where we would be. We would be so close to victory. And we allow them to make us feel like we're un-American and just detached from our elders. And because it's the same thing that World War II vets, a global multicultural alliance invading the neighbors, that's what World War II vets fought the Axis powers, and now it's the flip side, the parallels. It's low-hanging fruit. It's the easy thing. And I can't believe I'm the only activist out here that calls them racist and Nazis, and I don't feel dishonest at all. I don't feel like I'm stretching history. I'm defending what World War II vets were told they were fighting for. So, by the way, Fetch, before I go, you used to have a player that I could click, right, on the website, and now it downloads. And I get this standard player that pops up, and I swear to God, I cannot get yours.
You know what? I'll tell you what. When I was traveling this Thursday, coming in from the airport, even I couldn't even connect to my own show. I had to actually go to TuneIn Radio. So, yes, I agree. We are lacking here. We need to improve on
that
this issue.
That player that you clicked on years ago. Oh, man, I listen to you every Saturday.
You know what? I noticed it because I actually tried to use it myself this Thursday, and it didn't work. And I'm like, oh, this is not very good. You don't have anything on the front page that works.
What's the topic today, by the way? What are you guys talking about?
Basically, we have two guests. We have Alan Buttle from the Alan Buttle Show, basically talking about his work. And again, after this, you can at least go to 605-468-4702. And
I'm going to do it. I use that radio lines with Jeff Rentz and all the time.
Well, we have ours also. We're fairly sophisticated at this network. 605-468-4702.
I'll talk to you later. Bye.
All right, everybody. Alan, I'm not sure I'm going to actually agree with everything that Dan there was saying, but we do have an issue now where we need to start going on the counteroffensive, don't we?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's lots of holes in their arguments, and if we just if we all believe in so-called equality and all this kind of thing, which obviously is nonsense. But we as white people living in our own countries, built by our own ancestors, are treated like second-class citizens today by a Jewish elite with all the non-white immigrants and their children of these non-white immigrants that populate the Congress and obviously my the political positions in my country of the UK. We're being displaced politically, we're being displaced geographically, because so much immigration has happened, especially in the cities, that there really aren't many white British people left in the cities in the UK. They're all sort of moving out to the countryside and just generally getting replaced. And so we are facing this sort of assault on us from every conceivable direction. I think with the Because a really easy thing, because they've built up this sort of cult of Nazi hating throughout the world. I think a main weakness with us is if we claim to agree with what Hitler was about and things like this, it puts us in a very weak position. And I actually think that I was looking into works like Gerald Menuhin. He wrote a book called Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil, which is a book which really and he's a Jew, and he's from a very elitist Jewish family, and there he wrote a book called Tell the Truth and Shame the Devil, basically adoring Adolf Hitler and telling his audience that he was a great man and he was trying to fight the global Jewish establishment, basically. And but this Gerald Menuhin character is very interesting, because his father set up a foundation, like a charitable foundation, which Gerald Menuhin actually ran for a short time, and in which this foundation was very active in refugee rights, immigrant rights, and all this kind of thing. So it was from a very, very different sort of Jewish angle. And just understanding the history, how financially bankrupt Germany was after the First World War, and the Treaty of Versailles that left Germany in a terrible financial state, and then bearing in mind the help of people like Hjalmar Schacht to get Hitler into power, we're supposed to believe that the post World War I Germany was somehow not completely dominated by Jews, not dominated enough to prevent a very strong movement from occurring organically against Jews. And I question this. I find it extremely unlikely. And then when adding together some other sort of facts about the financial connections, I find it even less likely that Hitler was a genuine advocate of white survival. rather than being another one of their agents. But, you know, I'm happy to be proved wrong on that, but I just see it as extremely unlikely.
Okay, the problem I have with your side, Alan, with this angle is basically you're saying to everybody out there is Jews have a stranglehold on everything, and there's absolutely no chance of any defense against this. They were They're so smart. They actually were taking the most advanced European nation, Germany, and controlled it to its absolute demise, and control it up to 2099 still.
Yeah. Apart from the preface to that comment, which was that we've got no chance. I think we've got no chance.
Well, where's your chance if you cannot form a national type of underpinning like a national socialist movement, which clearly was anti-Jewish and clearly did have an open warfare against Jewish elites?
It professed to be anti-Jewish. Yes, I agree that it's supposed to be. But whether or not it actually was is another question, and that's a question of science, not just a question of there's a factual answer.
If you take a society and they legally basically force Jews out of the professions like they did in National Socialist Germany, is that pro-Jewish?
It depends where it's leading, doesn't it? And that's the thing. Like, the Jewish establishment don't make only very short-term plans, do they? Like, let's face it, they plan things very, very many years in advance. There's some evidence to suggest that the State of Israel was planned over 100 years in advance, and it fell on the exact year that it was predicted. I think a guy called Christopher John Bjerknes pointed out some evidence to that effect. So I don't believe in the very short term. You know, as far as it might appear, Germany was anti-Jewish throughout Hitler's reign. But I think it can be completely possible that they wanted to build this country up and then destroy it. And by destroying it, actually destroy all criticism of Jews, and instead of the European people seeing Jews as a problem, they now see Jews as the victims of this monstrous so-called Holocaust. And so long term, the Nazi Party was really crucial to Israel guaranteeing the State of Israel, and also the United Nations and the European Union was formed shortly afterwards as well. I'm sure you'll have heard of Count Kudenhove-Kalergi. Well, he actually invited Hjalmar Schacht, Hitler's president of his Reichsbank and economics minister. He invited him to his first Pan-Europa conference. And Hjalmar Schacht actually declared that Hitler was going to be the person to unite Europe. And obviously, Kudenhove-Kalergi was directly funded by Max Warburg, and for the purposes of this movement, which is as Jewish as movements come, and I think so. There's just quite a lot of evidence that doesn't quite add up if we're going to believe that it was a movement for us. And I think that actually I don't think we're hopeless, and I don't think that just because we don't believe the official Hitler narrative that he was against the Jews, I don't think we're hopeless because we don't believe that. I think actually we'd get an enormous amount of power if we unified and understood that the entire war was set up by Jews, and that this huge disgraceful slaughter was set up by Jews in its entirety from both sides. I think that would actually be far more uniting than our than half of our movement adoring Hitler and the other half not, sort of thing. But anyway, that's sort of beside the point, really. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that there's lots of evidence that doesn't quite add up if we're gonna believe that Hitler's one of ours.
Okay, from North Carolina, Frank. Welcome to Inside the Eye Live, man. Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year, Fitch. I apologize to the listeners for calling and interrupting.
No, don't worry, man.
It's conversation.
But it's Inside the Eye Live. Open phone.
I did have a couple questions I wanted to run by you guys, as long as you were both there together, and I'm not familiar with your guests. I also am a pessimist, by the way, Fetch. I don't like to talk about it all a lot because I don't want to bring others down, but I pretty much saw, like, 20 years ago, this was over, the fight was over, even before I knew about the Jews. I could just see the way things were going, and I see the main problem of our people, people that you would think would be on our side, is they're delusional. You know, they're not in their right mind. They've had this spell cast over them. And they're not in their right mind. They're not looking out for their own interest. And they've just been fed all this propaganda, this unicorn, fluffy, you know, love kumbaya stuff. And they just don't understand the nature of the real world and survival. You know, as long as you guys are there, I listened to Deanna Spingola some over the years and some of her guests. And, there were some things that really caught me off guard. Like, you know, I've heard that that actually a lot of Jews were allowed to continue living their lives normally.
300,000.
Even in Berlin.
300,000 plus. Yeah, 300,000 plus. It wasn't like it was a targeted campaign. So 300,000 Jews were still managed and lived quite well under National Socialist Germany.
Right. Okay. And a lot of them served in the military. A lot of Jews served in the military. Correct. And I always wondered, could that have been part of the problem as far as sabotage? Because we know the Allies pretty much knew what the Germans were going to do before they did it. You know, they broke certain codes and stuff like that.
One has to wonder, obviously pure speculation, conjecture.
Well, maybe Hitler didn't distrust the Jews as much as he was professing to, it's inconsistent with what he was supposed to be about, to allow 300,000 Jews to live normal lives in Germany at the time, surely. I would suggest this is more evidence to my assessment of that Hitler's actually one of theirs. But, you know, we have to take all these pieces of evidence and try and put together a logical picture, I think.
I would have to agree with you, at least on the surface level, at first glance. I would have to agree with your statement that you just made, because I was going to start a group and say I was able to get maybe 100,000 people in it, and I, you know, had allowed Jews to, you know, be members of the group, and this was like a resistance or something, you know. Pro-American, pro-freedom, pro-everything constitution. And I were to have allowed, say 10% Jews or 5% or whatever, based on what I know of the Jew, I would say that organization and its mission were pretty much dead in the water. They weren't going to get anywhere, because those Jews were going to infiltrate all the key areas where they needed to be and sabotage it and neutralize it.
Yeah, and actually Jews had already declared war on Germany many years before. In, I think, was it 1931 that there was an international Jewish boycott of Germany?
1933.
33 was it, I apologize. Yeah.
So, Frank, anything else real quick?
Well, I hate to say it, but, you know, as long as you got the guest on there, like I just said, I'm very pessimistic. And I know that things happen sometimes. Sometimes things happen in history, you know, and things take a course that you wouldn't expect. And you've got this phenomenon where the pendulum swings, in history from one extreme to the other. But, it just seems like our people are just a bunch of really soft, go along to get along people now, and are just willing to hand over, their whole heritage, everything that, Western civilization has brought, to the world. It seems like they're just willing to just readily just hand it over now. It's like they've been put under a spell.
I think they have. Anyway, really have been put under a spell. They've had many years of comfort and relative, you know, easy living, you know, many years of peace at home sort of thing, and many years of being able to devote their lives to sort of trivialities and obviously there's been an ongoing effort to destroy our communities, to damage our family units and all this kind of thing, which has led to, you know, the pretty ropey state of our society today, yeah, to say the least.
But, okay, Frank, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Alan, I have a question for you now. Where do you stand on really the discussion? Because when you talk about what Frank's talking about, it's really, for me, it would be how societies deal with two issues. And it's something that I know Frederick Blackburn and I had discussed some time ago. And that is the difference between the Jewish problem and the Jewish question. And, of course, the Jewish question is, what do we do with our Jews once we have determined that they are a problem? Now, what I have put forward is that Jews have solved that question because the Jewish question was always about what do we do with those Jews. Now the Jewish question has been solved. They have risen to such a level of power that we can't do anything. They basically have checked. They've checked us for now. We're not checkmated, although a lot of people feel that certainly a checkmate is coming. But we are not and no longer in a position to do anything, even though we know of the problem. Where do you stand on this type of idea?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean that we are still able to communicate like this and get our message out about the Jewish domination of our world publicly indicates that they haven't quite got the control that they really want just yet, even though they've, you know, they control almost everything, sort of all official instruments sort of thing. But I don't know. I don't really like to focus on any solutions just yet, because I think the only thing to really focus on is getting information out to people at the moment, because our people are, you know, very, very dumbed down and very, they're just not really there yet. We're not ready to create a movement. We're not ready to sort of start creating solutions, because we don't have that foundation of an understanding of what's really going on, I think. So that's where my focus lies. You know, okay. I'm sure there can be peaceful solutions. They obviously have their state now as well. And, you know, I don't know, but.
Actually, Alan, we are coming up on the end of the segment. Why don't you let people know how they can reach out to you, listen to your show, get your information?
Yeah, well, my podcast goes out on Grism, Mammy's page, which is Grism. My show is called Alan Buttle Radio Show, and I haven't actually made an episode today. But normally I make episodes every Saturday, and I've done. I'm up to hour number 11 on that now, and I've covered a variety of issues, including Jeremy Corbyn, the House of Assad, the Russia-Israel relationship, Hitler's banking, and a variety of things. So please go and check out my work, and there's an email address as well that you can contact me privately that you can find on my page. Thank you very much, Dennis, and it'd be nice chatting to you.
Equally, I will talk to you soon, and have a great new year, and hope things go well on your side as well.
Thank you very much. Happy New Year.
That's Alan Buttle, everybody. Again, Alan Buttle, he's got a new show, The Alan Buttle Show, and again, you can catch it every week on grism.blogspot.com 305.